this show is not for the easily offended. So if you are easily offended, go listen to something else.
Welcome to Indie Comic Book Noise, episode 387. You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter at Indie Comic Book N. I'm Steve Raker from the Comic Book Bunker with a very special episode of Indie Comic Book Noise. I'm joined by Andrew the LA Rabbit. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, Steve. How's the bunker holding up?
It is nice and cool down here this time of year, which is good. It's like free air conditioning. And also joined by Rich Shannon, who is an Indie Comic Book Noise first-termer, but he's not new to the bunker because over on Marvel Noise, Rich and I covered Marvel's history publishing War Comics back on episode 231 of Marvel Noise in November 2014. Can't believe it was that long ago, Rich.
I'm telling you, Steve, it's good to be back, and time flies.
That was a lot of fun doing those war books, and shortly after that time, you suggested doing what we're going to do here tonight, which is, well, why is this episode so special? Because for the first time on Indie Comic Book Noise, we're going to use the whole episode up to take a focused look at a now classic indie title from our youths and cover the first 16 issues of Mike Grell's John Sable Freelance from First Comics.
Yes. Oh, this is definitely a favorite of mine. This is how I first got introduced to independent comics, was through this title.
Oh, cool. And as far as indie comics go, again, this was part of a really important time for indie comics. So let me set the scene a little bit, as it was for us, as I'm guessing you're probably a far younger man.
I am definitely older than both of you here. I'm ancient.
But as adolescents in the early 1980s, the direct market for comic books had just recently dropped on us, and comic shops started popping up. So when you went, instead of just going to the newsstand or the used bookstore, all of a sudden there were these shops that had these weird alternatives to the usual capes and cowls that Marvel and DC had. Eclipse Comics moved from just doing graphic novels to doing floppies. Soon they got joined by Pacific Comics. Marvel came out with their Epic Comics line. And there was a really healthy line and market all of a sudden for indie creator-owned comic books.
Oh, yeah. I mean, besides this title, I was into a couple of them that first the company that put out Sable put out. I bought the Howard Chaykin book, American Flag. Yeah, I bought a few different ones.
Yeah, they were out of Chicago First Comics. They joined the scene. They offered up monthlies in Joe Staton's E-Man, an adaptation of the Warp play that Neil Adams did like some of the graphic work for when it was an onstage play. Chaykin's American Flag, like you said, Rich, and this book, Mike Grell's John Sable Freelance.
Yeah, like Grell's work from when he did Warlord for DC.
Absolutely. He had earned his chops over at DC. He had drawn Aquaman. He followed Neil Adams on Green Lantern, Green Arrow, the great Denny O'Neill, Neil Adams run on that book. And then he created Warlord and showed that he was a good writer and concept man, too. And right before this book came out over at Pacific Comics, and he would have done it at first, but they just hadn't gotten their act together yet, he published his other creator-owned book, Star Slayer, which ran for a few issues, and then eventually he moved that property over to First down the line. I've always really, really liked Grell's art, like a real soft spot, not only for like the way he draws the hair on his females, but like his indicative parallel line shadowing that he does on the faces, and he does his animals and machines and guns and stuff. Oh, man, he's just one of my favorite creators of all time.
Yeah, there are some splash pages in various issues that are just, you just stare at them for a few minutes. You can't take your eyes off of the how nice they look.
And Grell wrote and drew 43 issues of the book, from the winter of 1983 to the fall of 1986. He continued to write the whole series until it ended with 56, and then First came out with another series that Marv Wolfman, of all people, wrote for a while, and some other iterations down the line. But these first 16 ran from the winter of 83 to the summer of 1984. I was 13 years old. They cost a buck when most comics were costing about 60, 65 cents, so you knew you were getting something extra and adultish, kind of. Even the cost suggested that you were getting something more.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This was great.
How did you come across the series, Andrew?
I actually came into first in their second wave. It was the, they did all those beautiful adaptations of not just Moorcock, Elric, but Corum and the whole Eternal Champion cycle that originally had a graphic novel at Marvel. It was the pre-Craig Russell stuff. And once I got turned on to that, that led me to Whisper, which I talked about.
Oh,
I'd already
yeah.
been into ElfQuest. And so I actually got into Sable relatively late. And it's, I mean, late seems like a funny misnomer, but it had a longer run. And I want to tell people, I got these aren't the ones I read as a kid. I just got these on the cheap. You can pick these up. I mean, they have collected editions, but you can get these actual paper copies for a really good deal. I actually bound these in hardcovers. I don't know if you remember when I was doing the binding thing. So I've bound, like, I don't know, the first 50 or whatever into four hardcovers. So
that's awesome.
That's why I own them. And there's some funny, like, the columns in there. He does a whole history of independent comics. And the one thing I stumbled across that I liked was he's talking about ElfQuest, and issue 17 had an 85,000 issue print run.
Nice.
Which should give people context for, like, these comics were the massive print runs, just don't compare it to today. There's a proliferation of comic book shops, and it wasn't, I mean, a lot of them weren't run by very sharp businessmen. Most of the ones I knew went out of business, but you really had access to books that you'd have to kind of hunt far and wide. I think the selection was better probably in 84 in most comic shops than it is in 2016 as far as different publishers.
Hmm. I love this series, and these 16 issues are amongst not only my favorite, but amongst my most read and reread and lent out for friends to read at different ages all through high school and beyond, that I have down here in the bunker. Not only do I like the writing and stuff, but the characterization, I think, is really superb, because Grell, there's, like, not only is he dealing with heavy stuff, but he throws in these masterful touches of, like, lightheartedness. Like, he's not afraid to have his characters be the butt of a joke and show them coping with it well and just brushing it off type of a thing. Like, they can be embarrassed, and it's real good stuff.
Yeah, just to chime in, I know the interplay with Sable trying to hide his alter ego from his artist that he gets on there, and even the publisher trying to tell her to keep it a secret is really good to watch. And then when he meets up with some old friends, the same thing.
So I'm going to go through a little roll call here before we get into the actual content of the issues. And we're talking about John Sable, and he appears right in issue number one for the first time. And he's a Vietnam vet. He was an Olympian, became a game warden, and then a soldier of fortune in South Africa, where he lost his family. And then he sets up shop as a bounty hunter in New York City, high profile, high danger. But he has this secret identity where he moonlights. Instead of putting on a mask at night, he puts on a like a Marlboro Man wig and mustache, and he becomes B.B. Phlegm, who is a children's author, where the money is too good for him to give that piece up. So he's juggling these two identities.
But he also explains it's a little bit more complicated than that. There's a piece of Phlegm that keeps part of his old life alive and his family, which I don't think it's going to be a big spoiler, but
yeah.
The family gets fridged. So I think being the keeping the, he admits to one of the love, many love interests, that part of that is just keeping that one little piece of his, because he used to tell his kids these stories.
B.B. Phlegm's publisher is Eden Kendall, and she protects his secret identity, and she's vampy, and she's always trying to, like, seduce or proposition Sable, and she's the one who suggested that he writes the kids' books for money, and she hired artist Mike for the book, and she ends up being a really, like, trustworthy support for both John and Mike. And Mike is Mike Blackman, who is hired by Eden to illustrate Phlegm's books, and does so for 2 years before she actually meets Phlegm. And then it's a surprise to Sable, because Mike is a female, a pretty one at that. And then she discovers his secret and learns of his past via reading his manuscript, and becomes like a slow burn love interest for him. Her roommate is Gray Adler, and he first appears in issue 10. He's a performance dancer who makes things uncomfortable for a macho guy like Sable, because Gray is a real guy's guy, but he's also gay, and that throws John off a little bit. And he also ends up being a chorus for Mike, someone for Mike to throw her feelings, you know, should I, shouldn't I, with John, and the things she's wrestling with kind of off of Gray.
And they also can have a few jokes about, you know, when he ends up taking him out for the, he has the extra ticket and Mike
right.
can't go, and those sort of, so it's a nice change of pace, because I don't know if Grell is able to draw an unattractive woman, so it's nice to have some other characters in the cast.
Then there's Jason Sonny Pratt, who is an elderly stuntman who trained Sable in fencing for the 72 Olympics. And they become reunited after a decade by chance on a Tonight Show appearance. And he quickly becomes family to John. And he's like an Errol Flynn type who just loves the action and all of the pomp and circumstance that goes along with it. And then also the two minor characters that keep popping up is Harold, who is a New York City police file clerk and is Sable's go-to guy for inside information on the police force. And he's portrayed as like a happy, midgety guy who genuinely likes Sable and even like patches him up after he's wounded a couple of times. And Captain Joshua Winters, who is a New York City police captain, who represents those who kind of mean well but are bogged down by the speed of bureaucracy and the rules. He dislikes Sable and is always just looking for an excuse to haul Sable in, and thinks the police should get more respect, and that Sable, you know, that he should have such a high profile and get so much attention and praise for what he does.
Yeah, he kind of reminded me on any show you would see on TV, like Private Detective show, there's always that one cop that constantly hassles the private detective anytime he gets involved in a case that he shouldn't have.
Yep.
That's what this guy, as soon as I read him in the first issue, kind of reminded me of.
Issue number one is the Iron Monster, and we're first introduced to not John, but the children's author, B.B. Fleb, making a TV appearance, and then he goes home and doffs his, again, like his Marlboro Man wig and his stash, and at the same time, you get the image of Captain Winters condemning this John Sable bounty hunter for the notoriety he's gotten from bringing in this child killer. It's a nice introduction dichotomy. You're hearing about the one guy, but you're seeing the other one. And then Sable gets attacked in his home by the president's men.
Literally.
And Sable is, he's hired by Reagan to intercept an assassin before Reagan's address at the UN. And the assassin is known to John, and that's why they came to Sable. He's a former comrade in arms from his mercenary days in Rhodesia named Milo Jackson. Milo Jackson stands out to John because John was nursing a shoulder sprain and didn't join a mission where Jackson betrayed the entire squad and led them deliberately into a trap where they were all killed, and then he disappeared with the money. We also get to meet publisher Eden Kindle, and we learn she's got John's back, and it's established that, you know, he's never met Mike, the artist. And we also see Sable trying to help the police with warnings and feeding them info about the skills of this Milo Jackson guy with the upcoming address being given at the UN. But Captain Winters is, you know, he's got things all under control in his mind, and even locks up Sable despite Sable's gun license.
And the Eden, I like her introduction. She's in a nightgown. I'm like, you know, all the publishers we know like Joe Quesada. I don't think too many of them look like Eden. Yeah, they're just a great kind of, you get a real strong sort of James Bond vibe at times from Sable. But
no question.
I mean, things don't always go his way, but I do like the, there's always the ladies around.
This is the early 80s, so remember, Roger Moore was starting to get old now, so we were looking for another Bond hero. And Sable gets out of jail, literally with a get-out-of-jail-free card from the president, so Captain Winters gets to eat crow with that one. And Sable solves the puzzle of where Milo's shooting from and intercepts him, and they get their big, meaningful verbal confrontation and everything.
Well, I also like how there's no mention of Reagan, but there's so many hints about the acting and everything that you pretty much get that it's Reagan. I enjoyed that part, you know, bedtime for Bonzo and all the other sort of references that let you know.
The jelly
this book is set in the real, you know, they mentioned the Munich Olympics and we all know what happened there and everything. So I like that this was still a time when people weren't afraid to kind of nail the character and everything to a specific timeline. Like, you're not going to, I mean, I guess he could reboot it where he goes to Afghanistan or something, but I like that this is set in a time.
Yeah. Sable gets disarmed at the end, but the big climactic moment, he pulls these hidden blades that he stores in his belt buckle, and he guts Milo Jackson just in time to disrupt the shot that would have been heard around the world.
Yeah, the one thing I liked about Sable in this book is the man was not afraid to take anybody out by any means necessary. In future issues, there is one issue where he kills a guy by literally ripping the guy's Adam's apple out of his throat with his teeth. And you don't see that nowadays. That's from a bygone era.
This is true. That's old school.
Oh, yeah.
Issue 2 is Death is a Bum Deal. And there, Sable goes undercover to flush out and take down someone who's killing derelicts in the alleyways. But he uncovers this cool plot. They're passing information through scratch patterns on bullet slugs taken from the victim that are then scanned through one of those, at that time, newfangled cash register barcode scanners. And it's cool how they established the scanner and Sable's like knowledge and access to one via this offhanded, curmudgeon-like comment from a Jewish grocer in this mom-and-pop corner market that Sable visits in the beginning of the issue, and he ends up breaking up a robbery, much to the consternation of, well, and likely constipation of Captain Winters. And they even do the, what a nice man, as he's leaving, which I thought was funny. Maybe it's just that I'm from New York.
Well, Grell's a master of different body types. For those of you unfamiliar, Sable is athletic and lean, but he doesn't look like... This is before the 90s, so he doesn't have the kind of ridiculous musculature that has come to characterize a lot of these sort of He-Man books. Like, he's a man's man, but he could actually exist in a real world. And as you say, his one police informant's a short guy. The Jewish grocer's kind of a fat, older dude. Mike's really tall. I really like how he works hard to, in his character design, to make sure that even if you stripped out the word balloons or had it black and white, you would probably have a pretty good guess about which character is which.
Yeah. But how do you pass bullet messages via bullets that the police would be pulling out of victims? Well, they're being passed to the city ballistics expert, who ends up being a relocated Nazi, Sig Heil. Are we reading Sable or Fury here, Rich?
Kind of surprised me, too, but I guess, I don't know if the movie The Boys from Brazil had come out a few years earlier, and that was all about the Nazis down there in South America.
Right.
And this kind of suggested some Fourth Reich, you know, possibly on the rise kind of deal.
The first bum who was killed was the guy who wrote their code system out, and then the rest were all just cover. It was a pretty neat scheme, but Sable, he gets shot pretty good in the abdomen in the process.
Oh, yeah. John takes a lot of abuse. You find out in these other issues, the man can take a knife, a bullet, you name it.
Before the issue ends, we also get introduced to Mike Blackman, who John meets face-to-face, learns she's a girl, and he comes off so poorly that she follows him home and then discovers his dual identity secret. And this is the moment that really kicks off and drives the series forward. Like, everything before this was just set up, and now something's happened, you know, that changes John's life uniquely for the series here on out. Mike has found his secret. Issues number 3 to 6 presented a four-part story arc that were simply called The Origin. And honestly, 10 years ahead of its time, they put the origin right there on the cover in consistent typeface as a part 1, part 2, part 3, part 4, you know, which every comic company would be doing 10 years later.
This is about the best arc of the first 16 issues, I thought.
Oh, so good.
This whole backstory and everything. Really good.
Yeah, again, some of my most read and reread comic books that I have in my collection. While in the then-present time, Sable travels to Africa on this cryptic mission of revenge, that's teased in these one or two page framing sequences for the first couple of issues at first. Mike and Eden are discussing John's motivations and his character, and Eden passes along to Mike John's first attempt at a book, his life story, A Storm Over Eden. So as she reads it and learns of his past, so do we as the readers. It's such solid storytelling. And the images of Mike taking the content in, her poses, her profiles, her posture, they just, Grell's signature shading again, how he does those little parallel lines underneath the eyebrow, between the eyebrow and the eye and around the chin and the mouth. It's so good.
Yeah, I was trying to put him in company, and I thought maybe Gentleman Gene would be maybe the closest as far as just with all that kind of shade and pencil work. Maybe not the same detail, but that's the closest I could come up with.
So John Zabel, he's a pentathlon Olympiad in the 72 Munich Olympics. He meets a white African athlete, gymnast. They're both like almost. They're just not quite good enough to be at the top of their, you know, in top of their field. But they fall in love, and he follows her back to Africa. It's like great characterization, too. Like you were saying, it's the 72 Munich Olympics, so we all know there was a big terrorist, you know, event that happened there. You can totally feel their anguish and how it brought them closer together as they were like bonding over that, you know?
Yeah, it also puts in perspective their kind of achievement. Sorry, go ahead, Rich.
Oh, no, Andrew. I was just going to say, I like that they really got detailed in his backstory. You know, they bring up, like Steve said, the whole terrorist attack in that Olympiad.
And it was meaningful to them because it was a catalyst for bringing them closer together. You know, they're sitting there on the hill, you know, hugging each other like everyone was.
And I think it let them realize that maybe it was time to put that chapter behind. You know what I mean? Kind of.
Right. They're not kids anymore. They're kicked out of the Garden of Eden. Yeah, right. So they marry in South Africa. They open up a safari guide business, and John eventually becomes a game warden given his stance and his performance against poaching in the area. And meanwhile, he's got this house out in the veldt, and they've got two kids, and all is good. And this is where his children's storytelling skills get developed with his signature leprechaun stories and stuff. They take shape. The poachers, though, they fight back. And while John is out, they send a squad of 10 men to raid the house. His wife, Elise, fights well. She takes out two of them and seriously injures a third, but she's overwhelmed, and she and the kids are slain and left for John to find, which he does. And it's horrific. John burns the cabin and makes charred graves for the family. And
sorry, Steve, when you said John Burns, I was thinking John Byrne.
After
it wasn't funny at all. It's terrible. His family was murdered, and he burns his house because he can't stand to think of them left.
What is kind of funny is that he, from the charred graves and the soot on his hand, he uses that kind of guided by rage and anguish to scrape his fingers across his face and make his battle mask for the first time.
And his wife also gave him the whole Sable, they explain. She talks about the Sable Ant back when they're meeting and everything, so the meet cute gives the context for the Sable name.
Then Sable hunts down the 10 guys through the terrain. Only the leader and the wounded guy escape via a vehicle before he catches up to them. But, I mean, these sequences are intense of him in the jungle, setting traps for them and taking them out a couple at a time. It left a big mark on me when I was a 13-year-old reading these.
Oh, yeah. The best one is the guy that he nails to the tree and lets the ants go after him.
Well, he was talking about his wife like they should have, you know, spent some more time with her before they killed her and everything. So I was glad to see him get the extra attention. I like the big log that swung from the tree high from the trees with all the spears lashed to it that just, you know, it disembowels a bunch of guys. Sable proceeds this, like, guerrilla warfare, terrorizing poachers over the course of the next few weeks, trying to learn the identity of the leader of the poachers and who led the raid, the white-haired man. And there is 9 pages of him hunting and killing off these poachers. He's shooting guys, crucifying them, burning them, skewering them, cuts the guy's head off. Crazy.
Oh, he's gone, and he's, like, living in the the bush. Like, he is cutting off all contact. Like, he is going kind of a little out there.
The white-haired man, though, and he's cutting into the white-haired man's business. He's making a dent. So he sets a trap for Sable and brings 8 men with him out into the field. Sable takes them all out, but he gets shot by the white-haired man, and they're like on this cliffside waterfall scenario that's like this Holmes Moriarty. You know, did you get that kind of vibe? I certainly was. This is a big confrontation, and the steam is rising from the waterfall. And Sable throws a knife. He's disarmed by his gun, but he throws a knife at the white-haired man's gun hand and cuts his pinky off. And the white-haired man falls into the waterfall and the rocks below, presumed dead, but you never get to see.
It was also weird that they always kept his face in shadow. Like, yeah, we were going to recognize the guy suddenly, sure, or anything. But it was an interesting storytelling device, to, very cinematic to me. Like, you're never going to see the bad guy because, you know, that way he can come back later on. But you'll always know because the hand. He'll have some ominous close-up on the hand and he'll know, oh, that's the guy.
Right. Of course, this is the guy that John's gone back to get in his current time. Right. He's still alive. So John now, he's at rock bottom, and he gets recruited by none other than Milo Jackson to be a mercenary soldier for hire. And John, of course, excels. And we get to see his first mission in detail, which was a really a nice kind of interlude to the regular life story where John could kind of start over in that way that the military kind of breaks you down and builds you back up kind of thing. That's like kind of what this mission did for John, I think.
Well, I love the drug smuggling girl that's posing as like the high school, the college kid or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
The femme fatale with a duffel bag full of mysterious drugs.
And this time in John's life ends, he gets kicked out of South Africa basically when majority rule takes over. And he's a white guy, an armed white guy. So they'd prefer for him not to stick around. And that drives him back to the States, to New York City, where he writes his cathartic book, the one that Mike is reading, but it won't sell to any publisher. And Eden Kendall comes up with the idea to instead develop the children's stories that he told his children and come up with the whole dual identity scam.
And that's where they add the levity to it. There's a few scenes where he's forced to do personal appearances that he doesn't want to, and the humor is the rough man of the world having to interact with the kids, so it lightens up the story a little bit, because it had been pretty unrelentingly grim since the death of his family and hunting down those people and his alcoholic stupor and everything.
He's got one more hunt to finish here, though. He tracks down the man with the white hair, who wears Elise's pendant as a charm bracelet. Ugh.
Because, you know, that's what you do when you're really a bad man.
Yes. He makes his way to him, he gets disarmed, and he goes to his go-to move, Rich. It's the secret belt buckle knives again.
Telling you. It was I love the scene where the guy's adjusting his tie in the window, and there you see the outline of Sable's face on his reflection, and he comes straight through, right through the window at him.
Yeah, it was like the battle mask was reflected onto the white-haired man. That was cool. And Sable closes the loop by bringing the charm necklace back to his old homestead and hanging it on Elise's grave.
So you could kind of say that does close off, or finally closes that chapter of his life, and he can move on.
Issue number 7 is The Target. This would have made a great movie for a done-in-one issue here. First, we get B.B. Phlegm on a Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, of course, appearance. And John is reunited with his old, and I mean old, fencing instructor from his Olympian days, who's Sonny Pratt, who's now a Hollywood stuntman who got that Errol Flynn vibe going. And John gets hired by a key witness in a murder trial to keep her safe for the weekend until her testimony on Monday. She sees her double get blown up while the police are, you know, offering their protection. So she splits and calls Sable.
You're right. This had to be the plot of like 15 different movies I saw on HBO in the 80s like that. There's some artificial deadline, you know, like we just got to make it to whenever and then, you know, help arrives or whatever. So it's the 48 hours of just them against the world, an enemy with unlimited resources.
Sable and the girl crash and get supplies from Eden and Eden's car. You get to see how much Eden helps out John there. And they hole up in a building penthouse office and barricade it for defense. It's a pretty cool whole end sequence, too. The whole building gets blown up, but they miraculously escape in a, like, construction, what would you call it, like a bell, a scooping bell basket.
Yeah, like the digger part of it that picks up the debris.
And they had already established it earlier that the bad guys were using it to lift up to their position, so it was clever, you know. Always introduced the thing that's going to save you at the end a little earlier.
Also totally 80s, the girl he's protecting was a stripper. So that also was the final link in the kind of 80s action movie plot. But yeah, it was a nice twist. The bad guy blows up the building, and you think Sable and the Witness are in it. But as you said, they had shown that bucket earlier. And so then when the police get there, you see them waving from the bucket.
And the cover of this was like a whole title sequence to a Bond movie, too. You know, you've got the silhouette of the girl with the long legs kind of washed out without detail on her too much. And then, you know, the target in the back and Sable doing an action pose, and great cover. Issue 8 and 9 were a two-parter, Murder is the Last Resort, which is a pun. I only just got that.
This is why I was the James Bond thing kept going. Like, they always had those kind of comments where, like, whatever it was literally the same thing, because here he goes to resort. This one I liked, but it felt maybe a little overly complicated, like... I felt like maybe one less step in this, because it gets pretty over the top pretty quickly, but I'll let you lay it out, Steve.
Yeah, John gets hired by a female ex-con who inadvertently stumbled upon a complex inside job robbery at her place of employment, which is a upstate New York resort. And she's now on the run being blamed for the missing contents of the safe.
Upstate New York. Steve, you mean Central New York.
Yeah,
I really have to correct this. You of all people.
Sable, I mean, to make a long story short, Sable solves the crime. and it's told very well. He recovers the lost loot, but among the lost loot is a top secret military manual. And that is the linchpin for the next part of the story. The manual belongs to the resort owner, who's also an ex-military officer who now runs a shadow militia out of a base built in the caverns under the resort.
Yeah, this is the part that I was like, man, I've been to the Central New York region, the Catskills. I didn't know they had this many secret militia bases there, but...
But that's not enough. He's been hired, this shadow militia, by an unidentified Arab country to send a message to the West to help them negotiate by delivering an unarmed nuke to the UN just to show that they can do it, even without having to fire it along a missile. It's like placebo terrorism, if you will.
Making a point. Principled terrorism. They're not going to do anything. They just want to prove that they can.
Well, that's what the Arab country thinks, but the general resort owner guy double-crosses the beautiful Arab agent, and they actually arm the nuke. So this is going to be horrific, and, you know, World War III is going to start.
But his reasoning is that America can survive a first strike. This will be... even though it's a false flag, they'll perceive it as an outside threat, and they'll counter and nuclear war, and he'll survive. This is the part where the reasoning's like...
Well, it's Dr. Strangelove reasoning.
I guess his underground basement, he'll be fine in the base or something. Yeah.
Well, one of the individuals involved in the robbery side of the story ends up being an undercover CIA operative. So Sable and her end up trying to make it out of this situation alive and stop the bomb delivery. They get, like, chased by dogs through the woods. There's a car chase. Sable chases down the truck carrying the ordnance on a motorcycle.
She needed some kind of, like, double entendre name, though, for the studio. Like, Chesty McFighterson or something, you know, to really double it in. But he blows up the base, which I liked. the old trick with the matchbook.
All you need is a wick. Oh, in the end, too, I like Sonny was watching the girl who had hired Sable, the female ex-con who was on the lam, and taking very good care of her and all that. But at the end, Sable has a pretty good, although pretty politically incorrect, laugh about the only thing he likes better than smacking women is beating up old people, and pushes them into the pool. I like that. You could almost see the action freeze as the end credits came up, like an old, you know, 80s or 70s sitcom, you know? Or if it was a Leslie Nielsen thing, they'd still be blinking even though they were, like, frozen. Issue number 10 is called Triptych. This whole issue is a series of character moments. The beginning of it is like an epilogue to the previous adventure where Sable confronts the beautiful Arab terrorist chick and kind of warns her. They kind of warn each other back and forth. Sable also tries to shake Sonny while simultaneously inviting him to Thanksgiving, which Sonny declines due to all these family commitments that he's got. But we end up learning it's all an act, and really, Sonny's family wants nothing to do with him.
I do like how the evil terrorist woman sleeps in the buff, though.
Thank goodness.
Because, you know, you don't want any clothes slowing you down.
I drew that picture of her leaning around and giving him the kiss. There was a whole bunch of panels from this series that I drew as a kid. I wasn't that great of an artist from scratch, but I try to teach myself at least like line weight and composition just by looking at different panels and artists, and I really like to draw from John Buscema and Mike Rell as well. I must have drawn about 20 different Sable pictures from different panels and images from the book.
I've seen some of your Kazar, Tarzan. It's good stuff, Steve. We're so modest. Your sense of anatomy from your day job helps.
That's true. So Sable visits Mike's apartment and meets her roommate, Gray Adler, for the first time, mistaking him for her boyfriend, which he's not, because he's gay. John invites him to a fencing event and then learns his orientation, and so then he's like a little guarded and whatnot, but he gets over it. We also learn that Mike is interested in Sable, but she's really afraid to get involved because, let's face it, he's on a path of self-destruction.
Oh, yeah, you can see in that arc of his origin, as she's reading the manuscript, the expressions on her face. She was falling for him.
Yeah. Weren't we all?
Sable. Plus, all that radiation exposure may not be good if he wants to have another set of kids at some point in the future.
Sable fights a gang in the park and has a heart-to-heart with Captain Winters, who admits to Sable that he doesn't like him because he gets this attention and the notoriety while the cops never even get a simple thank you. In all his years, you know?
What I like, though, is it shows that Sable's not, like, invincible, because he's genuinely worried about, like, he can't just go and beat up, like, Batman, like, 20 bad guys or something. Like, he has a few encounters with street punks, and he's always, he does well for himself, but he's not, I like that they make it clear that he can't just, you know, he's not Superman or whatever.
Yep, he's a good fighter, but he's not a brawler, you know? He doesn't want to take a lot of punches. He's not built to take a lot of damage. So in the final scene, which closes a loop and shows kind of Sable's willingness to give of himself and not get the credit, which for a guy who is a bounty hunter, you think he wants to get paid and have the notoriety for everything he's doing. But it's a cute scene. Winters comes home to a delighted household because famous kids writer B.B. Phlegm is entertaining his kids. His car broke down out front, and when he is introduced to Captain Winters as a police officer, he takes the opportunity to give him that thank you that Winters had been looking for his whole career.
And we had a Gene Shalit cameo, because they're making a movie out of the book. So, I don't know if the younger listeners will remember, but he was a very distinctive movie critic who had a long career on television.
Issue number 11 is The Cat, where Sable meets beautiful blonde Maggie the Cat, gambling in Monaco. And there's a rare gem auction going on here in Monaco, and Sir Henry has hired Sable to protect his famous diamond from thieves before the auction. Sable does. He catches one of them in the attempt, which shows the whole comprehensiveness of the system that they have in place. But he keeps crossing paths with Maggie, and every time is just as flirtatious as the one before.
Well, what I thought was interesting, and I don't know if this was just the way Grell draws women, but I thought because she's a blonde and just some of the facial features, they made it similar to his wife, who was also a blonde. And I didn't know if that was kind of what was drawn Sable a little bit closer to her as well, as the resemblance.
He also knows he's got a gut feeling that he's got to keep an eye on her too, you know? They both get invited to a party on a yacht, and they develop a little romance, but then she slips him a roofie. And the next five pages are a silent sequence of Maggie pulling off the caper, where she steals the diamond back. And the last page just has Sable, you know, aw shucks, just admitting that she got the better of him and that she's the best.
Well, she also had a particular reason for this gem goes in the back. That's what sort of tipped it, for sure, if you had any doubts when she explains, like, the history of this and why it shouldn't belong to this guy. And she's with him, and he foolishly is explaining the entire security system. And Sable's like, I think you've talked enough about this.
All of these plots of all of these issues, too, have cool, sometimes complex, like geopolitical or historical angles that are driving them. Like the thing with the diamond. She stole it belonged to Cuba, but it was stolen, and an innocent guard took the fall for it in Castro's Cuba. And this innocent guard ended up being Maggie's father. So you're like rooting for her to pull it off and to outsmart Sable. Issues 12 and 13 is a two-parter, MIA. Now, remember, this is the time of Stallone's Rambo, the First Blood sequel, which was quite popular. So popular, Chuck Norris made 3 missing in action movies to try to get some of that change, you know?
One of my favorite clips is when they use the portion from Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends when Chuck is in the hotel room. I think it's the second one, and he's debating whether to go back, and they use a clip from the show where Spider-Man's like, you got to go back and save your buddy. But what's interesting is they actually use clips from 2 different cartoons. Now, only someone who's watched a lot of those cartoons would know that, but
that's funny.
I thought it was a little disingenuous, you know, not from the same episode. Clearly, what is he, watching a marathon block of Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends?
We need Spidey to say this and this. Make it happen.
Anyways,
okay,
I think
JP.
more trivia than maybe was needed for the missing in action films, but anyways, go on, Steve.
But these were all in the public eye. The POW. I mean, these early 80s. This was only 12, 13 years after Vietnam, guys. It wasn't that far out. We were still, you know, surrounded by the sometimes plight of the soldiers, you know, who had come back how they had been reintegrated and started families in some cases, in other cases kind of dropped out of society and whatnot. And then there was this whole POW-MIA angle.
Well, when they referenced that guy, I actually didn't I had to look up the whole thing about the guy that started that movement and did those publicized trips to Vietnam to try and resolve some of the missing people that hadn't been resolved. Like, it was a whole thing, and he roots it in the time. For this time, it would have been the time. Like I said, I didn't remember a lot of the actual real world people, but I thought it was interesting you put it in there, and thanks to the beauty of the internet, I was able to look up these kind of the different people that were live and actually involved in this issue. Being the MIA, not issue like the comic book issue.
If Rich gives his opinion on this, we have to get this vetted by the Pentagon, this podcast, before airing it.
Oh, and by the way,
well,
like,
first thing that this made me think about, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
The movie Uncommon Valor, and that was a mid-80s, you know, guys going back to Vietnam to rescue a guy's son who he knew was still alive, who never came back, and that type of deal. So that's what I got off of that.
Yeah, this was the time. Like I said, this was really in the public eye, all this stuff. You were going to say, Andrew?
Oh, I was just like, could like T.M. Maple not have a letter published in every single one of these? He's got about 10 letters in these first 16 issues, and you know, I'm always interested in TM Maple, but there's a point where I'm like, did they not get enough letters from different people? Because I feel like I've seen enough of his letters also in Marvel comics. So it was like the internet before the internet, and he was a very popular forum poster, apparently.
That's funny. You'll
find his, yeah, if you're reading these issues, like, he's got a letter in almost every one of these things. But it was interesting. My stepdad was in Vietnam, and in school we did a documentary where we took a couple of veterans down to the wall and filmed it and interviewed them about their service and everything. So it has a personal connection as much as one can that wasn't there, yeah. Sort of.
Yeah, my uncle was there. Fortunately, made it home with malaria, though, just like Sable. Issues 12 and 13 here, we learn that Sable was in Vietnam before the Olympics. Remember, his origin just started talking about when he was at the 72 Olympics, so we didn't hear what happened before that. Here we go. He was in Vietnam. He was an intelligence clerk, but he was around enough firefighting and danger to still get nightmares, you know, that it could have been him who died. We also see that Sonny, his landlady, has been caring for him because he's been, like, almost catatonic drunk. And she calls John, who learns the truth about Sonny being on the outs with his family and stuff, and tries to patch things up. Learns that Sonny's son, the husband of his daughter-in-law who he's on the outs with, was lost in Vietnam. He wasn't returned with the POWs. He was MIA. But there was some evidence leaked out that Sonny's son's crewmate was heard from and was still alive. MIA. So John tries some, like, diplomatic angles and ultimately decides to take a 3-man squad back to Vietnam and search for proof of living soldiers who are missing in action. Sable assembles his team. One is an old war buddy who lost his hand in the war. This turns out to be a great choice, guys. This guy ends up being really super loyal to John. And then their third is a former South Vietnamese officer who knows the terrain and speaks the language. They head out, with their extraction being a boat that's every third night will be 1 mile offshore, which I think is the whole caper is great. There's lots of characterization along the way when they get there of these guys, you know, like exploring what the war did to them, how it still eats at them, what it means for them to be back there. Each of them is hoping that it's going to be cathartic in its own way. Along the way, John gets feverish. Good old malaria, just like my uncle. And they end up having to leave him behind when the team gets pursued by the Viet Cong. John gets captured and tortured, like literally gutted. It's like 4 pages of him being beaten on. It's pretty bad.
Yeah, he could take a beating. Sable, I tell you, for an old man, he could take a beating.
I mean, he's hanging there, and the blood is just spilling from him. That's. I mean, you can feel the weight on his arms being pulled behind him. I thought so much of some of those poses that I tried to draw them. Can I make a stick be as long as it is and the arms wrapped around him tied so awkwardly like that and still make it look all connected? And, boy, just Grell's anatomy work. I just really love his stuff. And it's all in the rain, and he's sweating and feverish. It's tough. Fortunately, John's buddies come back for him. They free him, and then his warbound pal literally carries him all the way to shore, despite them being chased and stuff. He even swims him out to the boat, although they miss it. Dang. And talk about a friend. He even has a joint for John when it's his birthday. That'll get you over the malaria.
Now, you got to figure, at least in my comic book reading experience up to this time, and I was in my early 20s then, I had never seen this before in a comic book, and I thought that was just great.
Yeah, it wasn't shown, but it was implied that they used it. But again, right. it was part of the mythos, the cliche mythos of Vietnam, right? Well, they're there, he's getting this, you know, you can never go back type experience. Well, he's like getting a little bit of taste of everything again. The only thing that was missing was like a group of whores along the way that they encountered.
Also, they make it clear that Sable wasn't thrilled to be in Vietnam the first time.
Right.
Like, I thought that was an important distinction that he was not, it wasn't like he was raring to sign up and go over there.
When they miss the boat, they've got to wait out the rescue boat cycle for 3 days. So they do it in their Vietnamese comrade-in-arms home village. And there, they have their epiphany. They find the remains of the plane in the walls of the structures in the village. And it's Pratt's plane. And since the one guy can ask around, he does so, and they go and they find the remains of Sonny's son, including his flight helmet and his tags and everything. So they're able to bring that back for Sonny's family and give them some closure. And then the issue ends with an awesome gut check that, again, really hit me as a 13-year-old. As they're passing out of the area, you see in the distance in their background silhouettes of some farmers in the field wearing the, symbol hats to keep out of the sun. And Pratt's co-pilot had a very indicative look because he was a carrot top. And the last panel switches perspectives, so the foreground becomes the background, and the background becomes the foreground. Now Sable and his gang are in the background, and you see the farmer up close, and you see that it's Pratt's co-pilot who's just decided to leave all the aggression behind and just be a simple farmer and live out his days. It was pretty cool.
Well, he's got this haunted look that really is tremendous. Well, I mean, it really does.
He sees them and he's thinking about the city because he right next to him, there's New York City there. He's thinking about it, but he doesn't say a word to them. He could have spoke up the way I read it.
I don't know. I thought maybe he had just been broke. Like, at some point, you just kind of give up. Like, even though that's what I read into the eyes, is like he was kind of gone. Like, he had no shot at.
Or had just rehabilitated. Defected from the army, altogether. They had alluded to that in the beginning when John was talking to the people in the State Department that, some guys just decided to stay, some of the missing in action.
Yeah, it was great. I like that they kept it. I mean, for a comic book, it has resolution, but it's also kept ambiguous, which was a nice touch for 1984, 83, or whatever year this exactly was.
And, I mean, he's packing a lot into these issues. That's just a two-parter, for crying out loud, And all these done-in-ones, the amount of story he gets into this, these could be, well, let's put it this way. When Grell came back and did a Sable series in the mid-2000s, I want to say right around 2005 or 6 or so, he took issue number one and fleshed it out and made it a 6-issue limited series in its retelling. That's how much story he's packing into each of these issues. Issue number 14 is The Wall. And this is the 80s, folks. Now, Reagan hadn't yet dared Gorbachev to tear down that wall.
Not thrilled with the change in paper and coloring, but time marches on, Steve. Leaves us all behind.
The price hadn't gone up yet, though, but it was coming. At Mike's apartment, Gray, her roommate, introduces John to a famous Russian dancer who defected. And he wants to hire Sable to help him get his wife out when she performs in East Berlin, which is the only time they've, let her out of Russia since he defected. But, it's still on their side of the wall.
So it's the classic 80s Cold War caper. Sneak over the wall, kidnap the wife, bring her back over.
One after the other with these issues, man. Sable takes the case, and I thought this was clever. He gets some flack from Mike about how he does all of these good deeds, but it's for money. And as he's trying to get out of an explanation, he decides, he's bleeding, coming through his shirt, and she ends up seeing his scars, and he tells her, that's what happens when you fight for a cause and you do freebies. And he shows her all his scars from Vietnam where they had, like I said, gutted him.
Yeah, as much as I like that character, at times I just thought she was a little bit too preachy, and I thought, she's trying to change the guy, and I came to really dislike her about halfway
before. She's an artist. She's an artsy-fartsy type. John and the Russian dancer are the twosome that sneak into East Berlin, and they get his wife off stage and out the window and over the wall on this, pedal glider thing. And John provides this a little bit over-the-top, armed jetpack support.
Oh, yeah, I loved it.
On the helicopter, I loved it. Yeah.
There was some subsequent complaints in the letters, and they're violently arguing that this is plausible and this could happen, and all this site, and the, you know, about 2 months down the line when this all the letters catch up.
I mean, the most interesting thing of it, I thought, during the them trying to pull it off, was how, you know, the plan didn't go exactly right, and John knocks out a guy who recognizes the Russian dancer that's with him, but it's the guy who's the lead in the play. So the Russian dancer, even though he's a defector, has to jump on stage and dance with his wife that he hasn't seen since he's defected, and then they both have to get out of there from being on stage, literally in the limelight. But it was fun.
Yeah, I'm not sure that if you shoot down like a helicopter, there wouldn't be some repercussions somewhere down. I'm not sure, but I like the, you know, it's a comic book. You can have some fun with it.
Oh, yeah, and then, you know, he even takes out the guard tower when he's going back over into West Berlin, so it's amazing how that stayed off the news wires.
That was when Reagan said, tear down the wall.
And then for 75 cents on April 8th of 84, you can go to the Grimjack number one premiere party at the Americana Congress Hotel in Chicago. 75 cents, Steve. We could have went there.
Wow. Except
my parents never would let me go to Chicago.
But no, too windy. Issue 15 is called Green Hell, and, I mean, again, the 80s hits keep on coming. After a date with Sable, Gray shows that he's pretty cool in a pinch when he does this dance-off to get out of a confrontation with a gang.
Yeah, I like that, because Sable's a little, again, didn't really want to get in some fight that had no point, so why not have a dance? That's, they got movies about that now, isn't that the whole Step Up trilogy or whatever, and that just
now. What about breaking
against each
what
other?
About breaking and breaking to Electric Boogaloo?
I never saw. I'm not sure the plot of those. I thought it was some sort of code.
Here, Sable gets solicited to meet a female archaeologist, Indiana Jones type, named Stephanie Maxwell, and this is more than 10 years before Lara Croft would debut in Tomb Raider in 1996, and she hires him to guide and protect her through a Nicaraguan war zone in search of a tomb, which is possibly the Tomb of Christ.
I think I love the way Grell has Sable meet all his women supporting characters. Either, you know, like Andrew said, with the female Arab, she's in bed with nothing on.
Yep.
Eden Kendall comes to a door in, you know, a scant, you know, nightshirt. This archaeologist, what is she? She's in the bathtub with a small towel and a revolver.
Yep.
Yeah, this one, this is straight out of Indiana Jones. My only beef was, it felt like this was, sometimes he really pushes this absurdist, like that all these booby traps are still working after, a thousand years of, you know, sitting out and all the floor panels work and everything, but that's part of how these things go. You know?
Yeah.
It's just the Indiana Jones.
Dodging soldiers, helicopters, the tomb traps, puzzles, it's all there.
Snakes? Why did it have to be snakes? Where's that? Is that scene in here?
And the Christ, the white god, ends up being Thor. Or, well, a Viking.
Oh, they should have given him a hammer, you're right.
That would have been cool, right?
But he has a sword. Yeah, they could have given him a hammer. That would have been awesome.
They barely make it out alive when the pursuing soldiers set off all of the death traps. And then Sable makes it out with the Viking's dagger. Issue 16 is The Return of the Cat, where Sable is reunited with Maggie and immediately hopes that she's not going to steal the dagger that he brought back from the Viking that's on display at the event that they're at. And I like, in the last two issues, even though they're done in ones, Grell used these cool transitions. The rescued Russians ballet he and Gray are at. And then the next issue starts with them leaving the performance and encountering, you know, the gang that they have the dance-off with. And then here, you know, he comes back with a recovered dagger, and the next issue starts off with the dagger on display at the museum and the event for the unveiling and all that. I thought that was, again, good storytelling by Grell.
Also, if you're curious, First did a reader's poll, and they published the results in this issue. If you want to know, they break it up by age, gender, occupation, education, income, and preferences for new titles. So the median income, $20,600. and the gender 90% male, 9% 10% female. So
wow, it's a lot of females.
Quite a split that way. But yeah, and mostly some college or more, 71%. So it was a highly educated masculine group, mostly students, 35.9%. It was just kind of interesting to see this breakdown, and the highest preference was for new science fiction titles.
I was in seventh grade.
You would have been under 18. You would have had some high school.
No.
You would have been a man. Oh, yeah. No, you wouldn't. That's right. No. Well, they only have grammar in high school. They don't have middle school.
I quit reading comics in high school. Too distracted. I read up, made it up to issue 28 was the last issue I bought off the shelves. And then the rest I all read as back issues years later when I went back and filled in the holes. All right. So Maggie, now that they've been reunited, Sable goes home from the museum event, and he finds her. She snuck into his home and seduces him while also, you know, getting him to agree to help her out on a job.
And he has his crazy gun, too.
Yeah, I like the explanation of that. It was cool. I didn't understand any of it, but it sounded great. A secret formula has been stolen. It was an inside job by a group of otherwise amateurs, and they're holding it hostage, or they're going to share it with the world, making the company that owns the secret invalid. So Maggie and Sable infiltrate this remote island fortress and basically take everybody out. The leader escapes by motorboat, but Sable and Maggie are under the water because they're dodging his bullet shots. They dive under the water because, you know, bullets don't go straight under the water. But they explained earlier that Sable's got a gun that'll shoot straight underwater. You know, it's not passing through the plane, so he just shoots it up at the boat as it's passing over them, shoots under the floorboards of the boat, and takes the guy out. It's a pretty cool move.
Oh, this is the one where I had one small... I have a lot of professors in the family, so the crack that, like, this job was enough money to lure even a tenured professor made me laugh a little bit, because I can tell you in 1983, not all college professors were making a lot of money, so I like this portrayal that, like, you know, that's where the big money's at, being a college professor. I'm sure some do, but it is funny that I would bet the vast majority of professors in 1983 were not making huge sums of money. Go on, Rich. You're going to comment about the boat.
Oh, I was just saying, out of all the weapons that Grell draws in these first 16, that pistol there was the one where I actually had to question if there was actually that type of gun somewhere in the world, or if that was just something he just created just for this one-time appearance, because I don't know if this shows up again at all.
It is Bond, so, you know, there is that Bond element, so I could see him coming up with something souped up, you know, especially after the rocket pack and the couple of issues beforehand. Things are, you know, he's stretching things a little bit more, plausibility-wise.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And the formula that they came up with, turns out it was for Coca-Cola.
And you'll get the time frame, that could have been the new Coke formula.
Right.
This made me laugh. I don't know if you guys remember that... two Coke workers actually got charged back in about 10 years ago. They tried to sell it to Pepsi, and Pepsi called the FBI. They ended up busting them. So I always wonder if those people read this story, you know, and thought, like, hey, we could do that. We work at Coke. Let's steal the secret and try and sell it to Pepsi. So art imitating, except they're, like, obviously Pepsi didn't get, like, they don't. The formula isn't really that big a deal, so they just called the FBI. The FBI set up the sting, and those people went to prison. I mean, I think they're out now, actually. So, you know, maybe a team up with John Sable.
Well, that's our first chunk of Mike Grell's John Sable, the first 16 issues. There are, about 27 issues left of the 43. So it would be fun to try to chunk these up and do a couple other episodes down the line. I really enjoyed rereading these, but the further we go, the more we're getting into ones that I haven't reread as much as the others, including once we get to issue 28. I've only read it once, the stuff after that. I've never reread it. So this was like going home for me, and I really am excited by the stack of comics that are still sitting there to get to. So hopefully you guys will be interested in joining me to do that again.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I went ahead and bought the omnibus for this group that we read in the other group. So
nice.
It was nice getting to read those again.
I finally got to... Good.
Oh, go ahead. I was just going to say I went ahead and read... My home bind actually ends with the next, including the next arc, so I went and finished off the one. And what's funny is on the back cover of issues, they advertise a new upcoming comic, and the back issue of 16 is the cover for 17. So when I open my own volume, I'm looking at both copies of the cover right in front of me.
It's funny. Kind
of funny, but yeah, I'm in.
Excellent. All right, thank you, Andrew, for doing this, as always. Rich, thanks for suggesting this in the first place. Right up my alley.
Oh, love to, Steve. Glad you had me on again.
Yeah, let's do it again sometime when it's mutually convenient.
Oh, you bet.
All right. This episode was brought to you today by Mike Rell's John Sable and Coca-Cola. Have a Coke and a smile.
Wait, so when are those checks coming, Steve?
Listen to Andrew and I over on Marvel Noise. Find us on Indie Comic Book N on Twitter and on our Facebook page. And go dig up episode 231 of Marvel Noise and listen to Rich and I talk about Nick Fury and all those crazy Marvel war characters. All right, you'll hear from us again sometime soon. Later.
Call.